Testing, testing. 1, 2, 3. Hey, this is Dr. Herbert Friedman's talk at NRL on 25 years of radio astronomy at NRL. The date is September 15th, 1971.
The opening locum of the Joint Hubbard Center Lab for Cosmic Ray series for the year 71, 72, I guess. It's commonplace to hear that perhaps more has been learned about the heavens in this century than in all the previous 30 centuries, or maybe 40 or 50, of astronomical history. Of course, a lot of this has been due to radio astronomy, and a great deal of it has been due to the subject of today's talk, rocket astronomy, which I think reflects one of the real miracles of modern science. If you consider only the total number of minutes, or at best you could talk about hours, that we've had instruments above the top of the atmosphere getting data and consider all that has been learned in that very short integrated time. It is truly a miracle. But I think it is particularly fitting that matching that miracle, we have this morning to tell us about it, a man whose own career can be described as something of a miracle, and I talk particularly of his current career. I won't try to summarize for the people here who are very well acquainted with Dr. Friedman's many activities, anything like the full scope of them. But if you only consider the fact that he is a member of the President's Science Advisory Committee, the General Advisory Committee of the Atomic Energy Commission, and a number of similar government bodies, any one of which would easily take a man's full time if he could. That's saying quite a lot. You consider additionally that in addition to being a member of the National Academy of Sciences, not just a member, but one of the very active leaders who is frequently called upon to do some of the urgent business of the Academy. Of course, a great distinction for the laboratory that should have both Dr. Friedman and one of his close associates, Dr. Richard Towsey, as members of the National Academy. Privileged to be here at NRL in a place that could be called in many ways the cradle of the space age. And I think it's quite fair to say that the work in rocket astronomy of Dr. Friedman, his associates, colleagues, has had a great deal to do with the advent of the space age in science. And I will only conclude this perhaps unnecessary introduction by offering my observation that the more I travel around, and I do get around a bit here and there, both at home and abroad, the more it is brought home to me that a very considerable reputation of this laboratory in fundamental science owes a very special debt to the work of Dr. Friedman and his colleagues. Today we'll hear from him on 25 years of rocket astronomy. Dr. Friedman is suggesting, as I'm so absent-minded, that I had intended to tell you about the coming attraction a week from tomorrow. This will be on a Thursday, as is more usual. And we'll have one of the world's very distinguished astronomers, Jan Hort of the Netherlands, who is sort of the godfather of astronomers now spread around the world. We'll be giving our seminar that morning. I forget what the exact title is. Do you remember, Ken?
Structure of radio galaxies.
Structure of radio galaxies. The previous day we'll be talking at the University of Maryland.
I was a little late this year in responding to the occasion of our 25th anniversary of space research activities at NRL. In fact, it was sort of brought to my attention by my being invited to give a talk a couple of weeks ago at the Manaire Memorial Symposium in New York, together with a collection of elderly astronomers who were asked to give their personal reminiscences about the histories of their particular fields of activity. And I realized then that October 10th, 1946 was the date of the first successful effort in rocket astronomy, and we're coming up on this 25th anniversary next month. Not only is it the anniversary of NRL's work in this area, it really is a national anniversary. This was the beginning of the space research program in the United States. It's commonplace today for people to look back to Sputnik and identify that as the beginning of the space age, but that's really far from accurate. I'm sure that there are many of you in this audience who have seen the V2 rocket. And on the other hand, I see some of our distinguished alumni, Larry Dunkelman, for instance, whose work goes back to the very beginning of the work with V2 rockets in the United States. Dr. Kennedy is here. And the three of us are the oldest recorders of that ancient period who are available to us now. Well, let me, I'm not going to try to give any kind of a detailed review of all of the work that's been done in the 25-year period. I'd like to concentrate particularly on the early years and get some of the background history of how things got started and how they went. In 1945, American scientists were rushed to Europe on the heels of the retreating German armies to see what intelligence they could gather before the sources of this intelligence were dispersed and lost. This was called Project Paperclip, and Dr. Ernest Krause of the Naval Research Laboratory was amongst the scientists who were sent over to Europe. He had a strong interest in rocketry, and he made it his special mission to track down the areas, people, where work had been done on rockets. And he was very impressed with what he saw, so that when he came back to the laboratory, late in 1945, he began discussions with his colleagues about the possibility of initiating a space research program here, actually a combination of rocket development, a lot of practical problems, because he and his colleagues had been involved in applied programs exclusively during the war years, and many of them related to problems of telemetry and so on, which were relevant to the development of a rocket program. And in January 46, the Rocket Sun brand was established and began its activities. And people like Milton Rosen had a strong role in shaping the beginnings of that program, not only the push to develop an American rocket, but also to establish an upper air research program. In the same month for the year, January 46, the news came back that the American Army had discovered a cache of B-2 rockets and parts enough to make up about 100 rockets, and that these were then shipped back, would be sent to White Sands, where the Army would take over the responsibility for a launching program. Primary purpose, of course, being to study rocketry, but the Army immediately offered the possibility of scientists using the 2,000-pound warhead space of the B-2 to carry instruments. These B-2 parts were discovered in an underground complex in a part of Germany which was already occupied by the Russian Army, Nordhausen, and it was a tour de force to beat them in there and get these parts out before the Russians laid claim to them. The beginnings of the rocket program were shaped by a B-2 upper air research committee, which was chaired by Krause, and which had representation from the Army, the Air Force, the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory, Caltech, Harvard, Michigan, and Princeton. But I think it's fair to say that the primary push for research and the broadest approach to research came from NRL. The first B-2 rocket was launched on June 28, 1946, and it reached a height of 67 miles. The rockets were fired then over a period of years, and 47 firings took place, and the supply ran out in 1952. At the time that we first became aware of the B-2 rocket here, there was nothing comparable in the American ordnance program. Our ordnance consisted of small solid propellant rockets, typically the Bazooka, which is the infantryman's competition for the tank, anti-tank weapon. The WAC Corporal was a liquid-fueled rocket which was started in 1944 with a very modest goal of delivering about 25 pounds of payload for about 40 miles. And its purpose was primarily meteorological research. But the WAC Corporal was important because it grew into the Araby rocket, which became a major resource for research, which continues on through today. Now, the B-2 rocket itself was a giant by comparison with any of the things we had. It weighed 4 tons, including the warhead, and it was fueled by LOX and alcohol. It burned for 65 seconds and accelerated to a speed of 3,600 miles per hour. The first B-2 was launched from Peenemünde in 1942, and they began to fall on London in September of 1944. About 1,000 B-2s rained down on the vicinity of London before the Germans were vanquished. So that was the setting for the beginning of the B-2 program in the United States. Now here at NRL, the first discussions about astronomical research took place with a group that involved Dr. Hulbert, Dr. Towsey, Dr. Spring, Oberle, Duran, and probably several other people. Dr. Hulbert pulled out an old Hilbert Quartz spectrograph that had been used in the second full year, already had a distinguished lifetime, and felt that maybe you could sacrifice an instrument of that value for rocket research. And talked with Dr. Towsey about putting it in a B-2 rocket and seeing if they could observe the extension of the solar spectrum below the ozone cutoff down into the region near 2000 angstroms. Dr. Towsey picked up the challenge, but the further discussion, they realized very quickly that this was a completely naive approach to the problem. It just wasn't that simple. and they undertook to develop a rocket spectrograph, particularly for this purpose. The instrument which they flew looks awfully primitive by today's standards, but it involves some ingenious ideas. The V2 rocket had no stabilization system, so that it spun and yawed widely, and they realized that a slit spectrograph looking at the sun would not get very much exposure, and it would be very difficult to register a spectrum. So the entrance aperture was provided by small lithium fluoride beads, I believe about 2 millimeters in diameter, sort of a fisheye lens to get a much broader field of view and increase the exposure. And I think this was probably the most important reason for the success that was achieved with this early instrument. There were other problems, of course. The film was wound in vacuum, and the problem of the static collection of the film, the sparking and fogging of the film had to be considered. An anti-fogging, anti-static surface had to be applied to the film. Problems of sensitizing the film to the ultraviolet were undertaken by a piece of Kodak, and so on. Bear Associates were asked to actually build the hardware. I think in something like 3 months' time from the beginning of design, and this was ready for flight. And that really was a remarkable achievement. May we have a first slide, please? This is one of those rare pictures of the V2 rocket. And in the beginning of the program, we didn't have the elegant gantries that people are accustomed to nowadays to work with these rockets. A system of fire ladders called Mylar wagons, which had these ladders, could be brought up to the rocket, the ladders placed against the rocket, and then the scientist technician climbed the ladder to put his instruments into place. Next slide, please. The first rocket launched this way came down a streamlined flight, and this was the result. It dug a huge crater, I think about 80 feet in diameter, about 50 feet deep, and essentially disappeared. I know Dr. Towsey has a pretty picture of him standing with a small bushel basket of odds and ends that are unrecognizable with all of his first flight with a spectrograph I just mentioned. It disappeared in this type of crater, and after days of digging, all I could find was this bucket full of parts. The rocket had essentially vaporized. In the next slide, this, of course, was the historic result of the flight of October 10th, 1946. Received a solar spectrum extending towards 3,000 angstrom units, the ozone cutoff. And then as the rocket climbs from 2 to 55 kilometers, it gets above the ozone layer, which peaks at about 30 kilometers. And we begin to see the penetration then to shorter and shorter wavelengths down to about 2,400 angstroms. In order to achieve this result, it was necessary to put the spectrograph in the tail of the tail fin of the rocket and to sever the tail section from the forward section of the rocket so that the tail assembly would float down relatively gently instead of coming down in streamlined flight to bury itself in the crater. And it was that approach which permitted recovery of the cassette. Film was wound into an armor plate cassette so that it would survive even if everything else was severely damaged. May I have the lights, please? The NRL group was not alone in these first efforts to conduct solar astronomy from space. Hopfield and Thurman at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory were attempting to do the same thing, and they succeeded barely 6 months later. One of our most distinguished ground-based astronomers, Jesse Greenstein, was also amongst the pioneers. However, his first rocket disaster was sufficiently traumatic that he went back to Yerkes Observatory and decided to devote himself to a career of ground-based astronomy. Well, this October 10, 46 flight marked the beginning of a continuing program of solar studies that has eventually unfolded the whole spectrum down to its X-ray limit. In 1946, the Air Force Cambridge Research Laboratory entered the V-2 program, and they immediately supported the sophisticated pointing control development at the University of Colorado under Dr. Peterson. This was a two-axis stabilized bar, which we still use today on the early rockets. It became the standard platform for practically all solar rocket observations as soon as it became available in 1952. And of course, the great gain in observing time of this pointing device made it possible to go all the way into the ultraviolet, past Lyman Alpha, and to the helium resonance lines. Now, at the time that this work started, it wasn't obvious that the eventual accomplishments of high-resolution solar spectroscopy would come very quickly. And I am the group I was associated with began to think of what we thought were simple ways of doing photometry of solar radiation, relating it to the ionosphere. We had been working with gas discharge photon counters and had found that using electronegative gases we could restrict the long wavelength sensitivities, produce thresholds that corresponded to the photoionization thresholds of trace gases, which we put in the counters. And then the short wavelength limits could be established by the window materials and filters put in front of the counters. All of this is very familiar technology today and has been used very widely. At the time, we thought that we could make detectors which would pick out X-ray bands. For instance, with beryllium windows, we could establish a band from 1 to 8 angstroms. We could isolate Lyman alpha in a band, which was determined by a lithium fluoride cutoff on the short wavelength side and nitric oxide photoionization threshold of 1350 angstroms on the long wavelength side. We could look at the Schumann region of the ultraviolet with a sapphire window counter filled with a hydrocarbon type quench gas, and so on. And so we decided to try to buy a collection of detectors which would map the Schumann region, the region just outside of Lyman alpha itself, and the X-ray region as a function of altitude. We already had hints from some of the attempts to buy film packs by Bernite of the Rakusan branch and by Watanabe and Tausi in the optics branch using calcium sulfide and sulfate manganese phosphors. That it would be possible to detect X-ray fluxes and ultraviolet fluxes in these wavelength bands. Well, we had begun as luck with the first V2 attempt with this payload in 1949. Everything worked, and we could see a band of X-rays, 1 to 8 angstroms, which came in at about 80 kilometers. And then increased in intensity as the rocket rose in the expected way as a function of decreasing atmospheric absorption. We found Lyman alpha coming in where expected at about 75 kilometers. And in the Schumann region, we could see the effect of molecular oxygen absorption, but it was quite different from the theoretical prediction. Instead of the photochemical equilibrium model, which would predict a sharp transition region about 90 kilometers, it was obvious that O2 persisted to much higher levels and that there was a strong departure from photochemical equilibrium. Later observations with mass spectrometry techniques showed that O2 is a very important molecular constituent up into the F1 region, and that it has, as a result, a very important control on the structure of the ionosphere. From the astrophysical standpoint, this gave us our first evidence of a importance of X-ray emission. The flux was so strong that clearly it was a major contributor to E-region ionization. Lyman alpha was clearly strong enough to account for all of D-region, and its flux was of the order of ergs per square centimeter per second, so that it was far and away the brightest line in the whole solar spectrum. Well, this kind of work continued in parallel with the spectrographic efforts, and unfortunately, however, the beginner's luck didn't last. We tried again in a subsequent V2 within the next year, and on the basis of the success we had had in the first attempt, we were given a lot more payload space. We loaded this V2 up with many, many detectors, finer band intervals and wider dynamic ranges and so on. And the result was a total disaster. The V2 burned in two stages. It started by fuel entering the engine simply by gravity feed would be ignited and burn for a few seconds, and then main stage ignition would be called for, and the pumps would start, and the full stage burning would take place in a very spectacular way. Well, on this rocket, we called for main stage ignition, and the rocket picked up off the stand maybe a foot, and hesitated, and then sat back on the stand and fell over and created the most spectacular bonfire we've ever seen. Those people who were in the blockhouse have some vivid stories to tell about how their colleagues behaved under the circumstances. We went on this way. The Viking rocket development had been started, and I should say that right from the very beginning, in 1946, Milton Rosen and his group had strong ideas about developing an American rocket with this gimbal type of motor to permit guidance, which wasn't available on the V2. And it had been proceeding very well. They had reached the point where they were going to try to stabilize the roll as well as the pitch and yaw of the V2 rocket. And we were going to be given a major part of the payload space again for a collection of ultraviolet and X-ray photometers. And presumably we would put them all in the quadrant of the rocket, which would look at the sun, and it would hold on the sun to give us the attractive very long exposure. Well, the Viking took off, and it held very well to a height of about 60 kilometers, and just about the time when we were beginning to see radiation from the sun, it started to spin. The spin system, instead of stabilizing, simply accelerated the spin. By the time it reached 100 kilometers, it was spinning so fast that all of the instruments were torn loose from their mouths. So that was another disaster. By that time, we were having second thoughts about how one should do space research. The V2 was always loaded with a collection of instruments from the collection of experimenters, and there wasn't really the proper amount of coordination. People worked frantically in those days, just as they do today, and came out of white sands at the last minute with all sorts of patchwork arrangements to do their experiments. You would see bottles of bugs shoved into various nooks and crannies. Pieces of photographic emulsion for Powder and Gray experiments, and that sort of thing going on at the last minute. We always had a very guilty conscience about the cosmic ray work because we didn't realize what was being put in at the time that we were conducting our own experiments. And typically, we would carry strontium 90 or radium sources around our detectors for last minute checks and go over the photographic film packages, the cosmic